It's good to see all of you. I just want to talk about a few things real quick before we really get going and just make you aware of a few things that are pretty exciting. The first is that today, because of the way snow and the flood have worked, today is our 100th day of worship together. So it's pretty neat. And it's just really fitting since next week will be our two-year celebration for anniversary. So we're really excited about that. Another thing I want to recognize is Daniel has made it home, and so we're very glad that Daniel has returned home. So really excited about that. If you're a visitor, my name's Joe. Very excited that to have you with us. I'm really glad that you chose to come worship with us. And just want to kind of give you guys a heads up about a few things that are coming over the next couple of months where we're going preaching-wise. Today we're going to finish Esther, and we're going to begin in Esther chapter 8. So if you've got your Bibles, you can go ahead and make your way to chapter 8. But we're going to finish Esther today. Next week will be our two-year celebration. And then after that, on August the 1st, we're going to begin a new series walking through the book of James. And so we'll do that for now. I know some of you guys just went through James not too long ago. And so it could be that God has something special for us. And actually, I know he does because it is his word and he wrote it. And so he does have something for us. But we're going to be walking through that for the next couple of months. And that'll take us right on up to Thanksgiving. Okay, so, and then we'll get Christmas and Advent and everything. But if we go back to this past February 2010, late February, Jewish people all over the world were celebrating a holiday. And maybe it's a holiday that kind of flies under the radar for some of us. It's not Yom Kippur or whatever. But it's what's called the Feast of Purim. It's the Feast of Purim. That feast is all about the book of Esther. That's what the whole thing is about. In fact, some of the section of Esther that we're not going to read today in the later portions of chapter 9 deals with the implementation of the feast and how it's to be observed and those sorts of things. But the whole feast, the purpose of it is to commemorate, to remember, to celebrate God's deliverance. And so they celebrate God's sovereignty, his deliverance, and his justice. And today, as we wrap up the book of Esther, I want to zero in on those three things as well. They're kind of the overarching themes of the entire book, but you can really see them in chapters 8, 9, and 10. And so I really want to focus in on those three things: God's sovereignty, his deliverance, and his justice. And so let's begin reading in chapter 8, in verse 1. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave to the queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was to her. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. Let's kind of put the chess pieces back out, connect where we're at, and just by going through the characters. On that day, King Ahasuerus, okay, better known as Xerxes, gave to Queen Esther. Esther is a little Jewish orphan girl who became the queen. Her cousin who had adopted her is this guy named Mordecai. And then there's another character, Haman. Haman is who we've called Hitler. He had schemed and worked a plan to completely annihilate, eradicate, and wipe off the face of the earth the Jewish people. Complete genocide. And so he kind of schemed and kind of played the king a little bit, set that up for their downfall. But then what happens is God, through some pretty miraculous things and turns of events, reverses over and over. He reverses what Haman has planned and brings about something for the benefit of his name and his people. And so he does that, and we see Haman actually hanged. Haman's the one who dies here at the end of chapter 7. God reverses and puts it on his head. So read it with me again. On that day, that's the day that Haman was executed, King Xerxes gave to Queen Esther the house of Haman, okay, all his possessions. A traitor, it reverted back to the king, so he gives these possessions then to Queen Esther. So gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was to her. Thus far, all he had thought was that, oh, Mordecai's the guy who saved my life. And now he finds out it's also the adopted dad of my wife. And so he finds that out. And the king took off his signet ring, which is kind of authority. It's a symbol of authority, which he had taken from Haman. Haman had been the prime minister, and he gave it to Mordecai. So now Mordecai is the prime minister. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. And so we read that, and if you've been with us over the last 3 weeks, we really feel like the story could end here. Because the villain has been defeated, Haman is dead, and everything's been made right. Haman has fallen, Mordecai has risen, Mordecai's now the prime minister. It seems like it could be the John Wayne movie right off into the sunset, and it's over. But the problem is that the death decree is still out there. That decree, when I was talking to you a minute ago about how Haman was scheming to bring about the destruction of the Jews, what he had done was got an edict proclaimed across the whole land that on the 13th day of the month of Adar, which is late February, early March, that's why they celebrate this in late February, early March, Feast of Purim, that on that day, all the Jews in the kingdom of Persia from Ethiopia to India, that's what it spans, would be annihilated, killed, destroyed, and plundered on that day. And so that death decree is still out there. Haman is no longer alive, but that decree still exists. So while a lot of good things have happened, they're not out of the woods yet. So Esther then, in verse 3, then Esther spoke again to the king. She fell at his feet and wept and pleaded with him to avert the evil plan of Haman the Agagite and the plot that he had devised against the Jews. When the king held out the golden scepter to Esther, Esther rose and stood before the king, and she said, if it please the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and if the thing seems right before the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes, let an order be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman the Agagite, the son of Amadasa, which he wrote to destroy the Jews who were in all the provinces of the king. For how can I bear to see the calamity that is coming to my people? Or how can I bear to see the destruction of my kindred? Then King Xerxes said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, behold, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged him on the gallows, because he intended to lay hands on the Jews. But you may write as you please with regard to the Jews, in the name of the king, and seal it with the king's ring. For an edict written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's ring cannot be revoked. And so Esther comes to him and is like, hey, just write something that's going to cancel out that edict, that's going to cancel out the law. And Xerxes is like, I can't, because it's been sealed with the king's ring, and something sealed with the king's ring can't be revoked. It's kind of like our Constitution. I can't take just white out in a pen and go to the Constitution and white out what I don't like and write in a new law. The only thing we can have something added is if there is an amendment made to it that can nullify something that was already written, or the Supreme Court can do something else, but that's another story. But that's the only way you can add anything to it, is that an amendment has to be made and added to it. And so that's what's kind of going on here. Xerxes is like, I can't just eradicate it. It's been sealed with my ring. I can't do that. But what I can do is we can write another edict sealed with my ring that will make the first one hard to implement, if not impossible. And you know what, Mordecai? You write it. You write whatever you want. And so verse 9, the king's scribes were summoned at that time. In the third month, which is the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day, that doesn't mean much to us, let me explain it. This is 2 months and 10 days after Haman's edict had been written, 8 months and 20 days before it's going to be implemented. So there's still time. And an edict was written according to all that Mordecai commanded concerning the Jews to the satraps and the governors and the officials of the provinces from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, to each province in its own script and to each people in its own language, and also to the Jews in their script and their language. And he wrote in the name of the king, Xerxes, and sealed it with the king's signet ring. Then he sent the letters by mounted couriers riding on swift horses that were used in the king's service, bred from the royal stud, saying that the king allowed the Jews who were in every city to gather and defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate any armed force of any people or province that might attack them, children and women included, and to plunder their goods. Anyone who attacks, they can defend themselves. On one day, throughout all the provinces of King Xerxes, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. So the same day that the decree for them to be annihilated, Mordecai has written an edict that they can defend themselves on that day. And a copy of what was written was to be issued as a decree in every province, being publicly displayed to all peoples, and the Jews were to be ready on that day to take vengeance on their enemies. So the couriers, mounted on their swift horses that were used in the king's service, rode out hurriedly, urged by the king's command, and the decree was issued in Susa, the citadel. So for us, we're like, well, that's not a whole lot of stuff, just an edict to defend themselves. Wouldn't they probably defend themselves anyhow? Well, maybe, but think about the edict and think about what's going on in the kingdom. People are going to catch wind that what's happened. Oh, Haman has fallen. And what's this? The queen is Jewish? The prime minister's her adopted father, he's Jewish? And now the king's saying for them to defend themselves, and not only that, but take vengeance on their enemies? So this is going to have a pretty profound effect. And so look at verse 15. People know the greatness that Mordecai has risen to. Then Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white, with a great golden crown and a robe of fine linen and purple. And the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. All right, so one of the first times we saw Mordecai, sackcloth and ashes. Now, crown, royalty, purple, fine linen. And the Jews are excited about this. The whole city is excited about this. Verse 16, the Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. And in every province and in every city, wherever the king's command and his edict reached, the new edict, there was gladness and joy among the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many from the peoples of the country declared themselves Jews, for fear of the Jews had fallen on them. Now in the 12th month, here we go, this is it, which is the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's command and edict were about to be carried out, both the edicts, this is the day, on that very day, when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain mastery over them, reverse. We've seen this so many times. The reverse occurred. The Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. We are seeing God's sovereignty and deliverance played out before our eyes right here. The Jews gathered in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Xerxes to lay hands on those who sought their harm. And no one could stand against them, for the fear of them had fallen on all peoples. All the officials of the provinces and the satraps and the governors and the royal agents also helped the Jews, for the fear of Mordecai had fallen on them, God's sovereign hand. For Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces, for the man Mordecai grew more and more powerful. And so Mordecai had risen to power. He had become this great man in the king's house, and God had once again made a way. He had once again provided for his people. Because Mordecai just happened, all these things again, just happened to become the prime minister. He just happened to be the one asked to write the edict. It just happened, right? You know, all week I've been struggling with this passage a little bit, and I've been like, okay, Joe, you've talked about God's sovereignty from this every single week. Don't do it again this week. You need to come up with something new. But as I studied the script, I can't get away from it. Because that is the message of the book of Esther, is that he is in control. And though, as we've talked about, he's never mentioned once in the entire book, his fingerprints are on every single page. And so I cannot get away from it. I can't help but herald the fact that God is sovereign. He's in control. He was working in these situations. And so God's sovereignty is not like a topic. I'm like, all right, topics I want to cover this year. God's sovereignty, his justice, check, check. And I move on to some others. It's life. I mean, it's the air we breathe. Literally. It's the beating of your heart. That's by God's sovereign will, that your heart. He's in control. And so maybe you've been, maybe you've noticed some of this in your life. Maybe like my community group and other community groups. And if you're not in a community group, you need to get in one. See me if you want to talk about that. Or see Tom, he'd know better. talked about last week. We talked about how we could recognize God's sovereignty in our life and how you can look back on things and you can see how God put pieces together and it came out. And we look back and we're like, wow, that's really cool. That's really neat what God did. But what I want to remind us of is why don't we look back on that and we say that's really, really cool what he did. What you're living right now is still part of that. His sovereignty didn't stop with this one cool event. His sovereignty is what you're going through right now. And so no matter what that may be, no matter what it is that you are going through at this time, you can rest in his sovereign hands. Nothing catches him off guard. Nothing surprises him. His silent, sovereign hand is just as strong today as it was in the 5th century BC. And so we celebrate that fact. And so not only do we celebrate God's sovereignty, we want to celebrate God's deliverance, just like the Feast of Purim. Celebrate God's deliverance. Let's look at chapter 9, verse 5. The Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and did as they pleased to those who hated them. In Susa, the citadel itself, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. And also killed Parshandasa and Dolphin and Aspatha and Paratha and Adelia and Aradatha and Parmashta and Arasai and Aradai and Vasitha, the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Amadatha, the enemy of the Jews. But they laid no hand on the plunder. That very day, the number of those killed in Susa, the citadel, was reported to the king. And the king said to Queen Esther, "In Susa, the citadel, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and also the 10 sons of Haman. What then have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now, what is your wish? It shall be granted you. And what further is your request? It shall be fulfilled." And Esther said, "If it please the king, let the Jews who are in Susa be allowed tomorrow also to do according to this day's edict. And let the 10 sons of Amadatha be hanged on the gallows," again, impaled on stakes. So the king commanded this to be done. A decree was issued in Susa, and the 10 sons of Haman were hanged. And the Jews were in Susa gathered also on the 14th day of the month of Adar, and they killed 300 men in Susa, but they laid no hands on the plunder. And so God's delivering his people. Excuse me. God is delivering his people. That's who God is, and that's what God does. He's kind of like our own Bryce Shanklin and Michael Bond. They deliver the mail. God delivers his people. And so I want to talk a little bit about this in two ways. A micro and macro perspective. All right, I want to look at it in a micro and macro perspective. Let's check the micro first. Microscope in on what exactly is going on here in the story of the Jews here in the book of Esther. From a micro perspective. As I kind of track that story and look at some of what's going on, I can notice very easily that God didn't pretend, he did not deliver them from the storm, just from the destruction of it. They were still attacked on the 13th day of the month of Adar, but they weren't alone in that. God was with them. And I think there's a principle there for us in the micro, and that's that God doesn't always deliver us from the storms of our life, but that he wades through the storms with us. And you've got that poem, Footprints in the Sand, which is really good. And a lot of times we look back and we're like, well, I was walking, Jesus was walking, and then all of a sudden there's one set of footprints. Jesus, where did you go in the hard times? Why did you leave me? It's like, it's not that I left you, it's that I carried you then. He doesn't always deliver us from the storm, but he protects us in the midst of it. And for all of us in here, you know, we've all got a story. We all have, at least on some level, a storm that you're walking through. On some level. Now, maybe your storm is just a small low-pressure system, you know, developing spotty showers. Da-da-da-da. I am Charlie Neese, after all. But for some of us, it's a whole lot more than spotty showers. Some of us are facing a hurricane. And it can be a hurricane of health. We have that in our church. It can be a hurricane of finances, a hurricane of unemployment, a hurricane of marital issues, a hurricane of your kids or your parents or your friends making stupid, harmful choices with their life, a hurricane of an addiction you have. Whatever the hurricane is, the storm that you're in, God's with you in it. And He's just as good in it with you as He was before you went in it and as He will be forever. He doesn't change. His goodness doesn't change. He is unchangeable. And you haven't done, maybe your mind's going there and you're thinking, well, maybe I've done something. Maybe I've done something that's beyond God forgiving me. The blood of Christ can't cover that. There is nothing that the blood of Christ can't cover. And God's not, and we said this at the park a couple weeks ago, God's not in love with some future version of you, some idealized future version of you. He loves you as you are now. Thank you, Jeff. And He's willing, and He just says, come to me now. As you are. You've got to clean yourself up. Just come. Find rest for your souls as you are. But I love you so much, I'm not going to leave you there. I am going to change you. I am going to work in you. So Christ doesn't promise a life of ease and storm-free. But He does promise us a life where there's an answer to the storm and where there's an anchor in the storm, and that is Christ. So that's the micro. Let's take it up to the macro real quick of God's deliverance. As we talk about the macro of God's deliverance is one of the major themes of this book. One of the major themes of the entire book. And I want you to listen to me on this. I want you to hear this. This book teaches us that God will deliver His people. Okay? Now that doesn't mean necessarily from physical death or martyrdom, but it does teach us that God will preserve His people for His own purpose and for His own glory. There is nothing that can or will ever destroy the church of King Jesus. People will be harmed, people will be killed, people will be persecuted, people will be maimed, people will be martyred, but there is nothing that can destroy the church of King Jesus ever. And by church, I'm talking about the invisible church. That's made up of all believers of all time across all geographic locations. The one people of God of which we are all members, us and Esther. One people of God, the church of the King Jesus. That church will never be destroyed. Can never be destroyed. And that's what's so urgent about the book of Esther as we pull back and get the big picture. Because what is at stake in the book of Esther? What's on the line? It's not just the eradication of the Jewish people, but it's what the Jewish people were leading to. God had made a promise to Abraham, a promise of seed, a promise of one who's to come, of one who is to deliver. And so the ESV, if you have an ESV study Bible, man, it just nails it perfectly when it writes that the book of Esther connects to a much larger story that runs all the way from Abraham to Christ and through Him to His church. If Haman had succeeded, the Jewish people as a whole would have been destroyed, and the story of God's saving work in and through Abraham's descendants would have come to an end. There would have been no fulfillment in Christ, and therefore no gospel, and therefore no Christian church. That's what's at stake. If the Jewish people are eradicated, there is no Jesus, there is no Savior, there is no deliverer. But the church of Jesus Christ, His people, cannot be destroyed. We see it over and over. Isaiah 54 talks about it. Matthew 16 says the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And then one that's maybe not as familiar out of Hebrews 12 I want to read to you. But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to innumerable angels and festal gathering, and to the assembly, that is the word church, ekklesia in the Greek, and to the church of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. See that you do not refuse him who is speaking, for if they did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, much less will we escape if we reject him who warns from heaven. At that time his voice shook the earth, but now he has promised, yet once more I will shake not only the earth but also the heavens. This phrase, yet once more, indicates the removal of things that are shaken. That is, things that have been made, in order that the things that cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. And thus, let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe. For our God is a consuming fire. The church of King Jesus cannot be destroyed. For our God is a consuming fire, which brings us to the third point about God's justice. And so make your way back to Esther chapter 9. Chapter 9, verse 16. Haman fought against God. He got taken out. The people who fought against God, we've seen 800 killed so far, 500 on the first day, 300 on the second day. Verse 16, now the rest of the Jews who were in the king's provinces also gathered to defend their lives and got relief from their enemies and killed 75,000 of those who hated them. But they laid no hands on the plunder. And then the rest is pretty much about the Feast of Purim and how it began. But 75,000 people got taken out in a day. Multiply September 11th by 25 and you're in the realm there. In a day across the kingdom. 75,000 people killed. God punishes sin. God punishes wickedness. God punishes evil. God is just. But that's one of God's attributes we don't think a lot about. We sometimes forget about. We don't want to think about his justice, that he has a hatred towards sin, that sin will be punished. We don't like to think about that. But it's every bit as much as part of who God is, as is his love, his mercy, his kindness, his grace. Let me give you an example of how we'll do this. Exodus chapter 34. Moses is describing who God is. And a lot of us are either familiar with this, some of us maybe have even memorized it, or you've read it if you've read the Bible, and if not, then I'm about to read it to you. But it goes like this. The Lord, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger and abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands, forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. That is an awesome statement of who God is. Amazing statement of who God is. Gracious, compassionate, slow to anger, abounding in love, faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands, forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. But when it's preached a lot of time, they stop there. But the next phrase says this, yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. God is just. He is holy and he is perfect. And because he is, he will exact justice. But our hearts and our minds don't want to allow ourselves to accept that because we know what that means for us. Then, if God really is just, what does that mean for me? And so we'll play some silly games with ourselves, and we'll recreate God. And we'll create God. We'll recreate God into the janitor of your high school. Oh no, my janitor at my high school, I mean, he was the guy, he was everybody's friend. Did no wrong. And so we'll recreate him into this carefree janitor who walks by and just sweeps the dirt of our lives underneath the rug and tries to ignore it, pretend it didn't happen. Nobody knows. And that's what we will recreate God into that person. Many of us can't even conceive. We will not even conceive of a God who would judge our sin. But then on the flip side of that, and in other situations, we don't want the janitor. We want God the just. And so, you know, what we will say is, God, yeah, overlook my sin, but you rain down justice on them. Forgive me, but don't forgive the terrorists. Forgive me. Look past my stuff, but don't look past this person. They deserve your wrath. Be just with them. Greg Gilbert, in his book, What is the Gospel, says, nobody wants a God who declines to deal with evil. Okay, we don't want a God who is going to sweep it under the rug. We really don't. Evil must be dealt with. We're glad that God does. Nobody wants a God who declines to deal with evil. They just want a God who declines to deal with their evil. We just want a God who declines to deal with our evil, my evil. You can look past that, but them, no. But me, yeah, look past it. And so this is where the rubber hits the road for us, because God is a God of justice. He punishes sin. He doesn't tolerate it. He doesn't toy around with it. He doesn't play with it. He punishes it and he destroys it. That's who he is. And so on the micro level, we see this in 75,000 people here. On the macro level, all of us are under his justice, because all of us have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Every single one of us. We're all sinners. And this is not me trying to judge you. This is the Bible judging us. This is the Bible judging us, that we are all sinful. We have all rebelled against God. We have all committed treason against the King of the universe. And just like when you commit treason, I even checked this morning in the United States, what is the penalty for treason against the U.S.? Death. What is the penalty for treason against the King of the universe? Death. Spiritual death. And so we are all deserving of that, because we've all rebelled, we've all turned, we follow our own ways, we want our own wishes. I don't want what you want. I know what you say, and I don't care. I'm going to do this. We've all done that. We've all been there. And so because of that, we are all, just as these 75,000, we are under God's justice. And we will suffer for all eternity under his wrath in a very real and horrible place called hell. And we don't like to talk about that either. But that's the bad news. Now let me tell you about the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ and what Jesus has done for us. I've said it before, but the big message of Christianity is not that God has wrath against sinners, but that he saves. That's the message that we herald. Not that we're condemned as sinners, but that Jesus will save us out of that. That he will rescue us from our sin. That he delivers. That he will deliver us. And so this takes us right back to God's deliverance. To God's deliverance. Where, because God delivered his people through Persia in this book of Esther. Just as he delivered his people out of Egypt through the Exodus. And all of this led to the delivery of the deliverer in a stable, in a manger. The deliverance here led to the delivery of the deliverer who has come to deliver you and I. That's the good news of the gospel. And so this is where the love of God gets really scandalous, because what we deserve isn't what we get. We're the ones who have sinned. We're the ones who have rebelled. We're the ones who have turned away from God. And we're the ones who are deserving of His wrath to be poured out upon us. But instead, God sent Jesus to be that substitute for us, where we don't get what we deserve. We get what Jesus deserved. Jesus was the sinless one. We were the sinful ones. Jesus was the righteous one. We were the unrighteous one. But on the cross, that exchange takes place. 2 Corinthians 5:21, my favorite verse in the whole Bible. For He made Him, Jesus, who knew no sin, to be sin, to become sin, taking on our sin on our behalf, so that we might become the righteousness of God in Him. The cross is an exchange where Jesus takes our sin upon Himself. He takes it away from us and gives us in return His righteousness, so that when God looks at you now through Christ, He doesn't see the sinner that you are. He sees the spotless Son, His spotless Son, who was sent to deliver you and sent to deliver me. So on the cross, that's where it's so scandalous, because Jesus took my sin. I deserve to be punished. He was punished for me. I deserve the wrath of God. He took it for me. He deserves the blessing of God. I get the blessing of God. That's the hope of the gospel. And then He rises again 3 days later, proving the fact that He has power to forgive, and that He is God's Son, and He is over Satan and sin and death and hell and the grave. He has conquered those things. And He offers deliverance to you and to me and to anyone who would simply repent and believe. Turn away from their sin. Turn to Him. And receive the gift that He offers. Deliverance from the wrath that we deserve, because He paid it on our behalf, scandalously substituting Himself. That's what Esther points to. God delivered. God still delivers today. He delivers from His own justice that we should suffer under. He delivers. For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whosoever would believe in Him should not perish, but have everlasting life. And God has made a way. He has sent the Deliverer. So turn to Him. I'm going to ask us to do something a little bit different. I'll ask all of you to stand as I pray. Do a little bit different today. Go ahead and stand, bow your heads, and let's pray together. Father, Lord, You have delivered in the past, and You stand to deliver today. God, I know that in this room right now, that there are those who have never, they have never taken hold of the deliverance that You offer. They have never received the gift of salvation that You offer. And so they are still under Your coming wrath. Sin will be punished. Because You are just, sin must be paid for. Because You're holy, You're righteous, You're good. You will not look upon sin. It must be punished. It must be paid for. But in love, You sent Jesus to pay it for us so that we don't have to. So God, I pray right now that Your Spirit would press on us. Press on us, those who have never trusted You by faith, that You would press on them now the hope that is in You, the escape that is in You, the deliverance that is in You, the peace that You offer to us and in us because of Christ, that they would take hold of that now. And God, for others of us, God, we have been so far from You Maybe we make some sort of proclamation at a young age that, but we know in our heart of hearts that that was just an outward act. There's been no change. If we would search our hearts, we would say, there's been no change. And we know where there's, we never see in the Bible a place where someone is confronted with the Jesus of the Bible, with Christ, and is not changed. It is impossible. And so, Father, let us be cognizant enough to examine our hearts and say, I haven't been changed. And so, maybe I'm not saved. Maybe that was just, and maybe in our hearts we already know that. We know we just did an act. We just prayed a prayer. We just repeated after somebody to make mom and daddy happy. God, let us fear you more than we fear man, more than we fear to acknowledge that all this time we haven't been saved. And so, God, today make this a day of salvation for anyone who would call upon your name. Father, pour your Spirit out now on those who do not, who have not taken hold of the deliverance you offer. And those who've maybe faked it in the past, let us cling to you. Let us run to you, to the deliverance you offer, to the forgiveness you offer, to the freedom from slavery that you offer. Please, God, now in this time, work in that way. Let me read to you the way the book ends. Chapter 10. King Xerxes imposed a tax on the land, great, and on the coastlands of the sea, and all the acts of his power and might, and the full account of the high honor of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the books of the chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Xerxes, and he was great among the Jews, and popular with the multitude of his brothers, for he sought the welfare of his people, and spoke peace to all his people. And so as we go knowing God's sovereignty, God's deliverance, and God's justice. And go seeking the welfare of the people and the peace of the people.